So let's start. It was 10 p.m. at night, and you're not going to be able to quite see it. There's actually, down below there where you can't quite see, is actually Mount Rainier, which is about 14,000 feet up. I was standing with my son and daughter outside the historic lodge at Mount Rainier in Washington State. The sky was so clear that when we looked up, you could actually see along the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, for someone like myself who lives in a suburban area where artificial lights basically obscure hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy, this was an awe-inspiring experience. And it gave me the feeling that we human beings are part of something greater than we can usually conceive. Maybe you've had such an encounter in your life thus far, or if not, maybe you will someday. Many people have had an experience like this. Nearly two centuries ago, a young man named Charles Darwin had a similar experience. The year was 1831. Darwin was 22 years old, recently graduated from college. He wanted to explore the ecosystems of the world, so he joined the expedition of the HMS Beagle in its voyage to South America and beyond. 2 months into his tour, he was walking in the midst of a Brazilian rainforest. Confronted by the sheer beauty, Darwin experienced an overwhelming sense of awe. Surely, he thought, man was more than a mere animal, and there was some greater purpose behind nature than just physical survival. Unfortunately, Darwin's sense of awe about nature and about human beings and our specialness did not last. Fast forward to the ending chapter of his life when he wrote his autobiography. Reflecting on his earlier sense of awe in that Brazilian rainforest, Darwin wrote that now not even the grandest scenes in nature would inspire such a view. Why? He explained that the evidence of exquisite design and purpose he once saw in nature failed now that he had discovered his law of natural selection. Now, there are many, many different influences that shape our culture's views of human beings. And I know that. But I've become convinced that one of the important streams, one of the really significant streams that impacts all of our views of human beings has come in the form of Darwinian biology. Now, I know how many of you were here for when my colleague Doug Axe was here several weeks ago? Okay, so, you know, he talked about the science of that. My background is more in the social sciences, so I'm going to talk about how Darwin's theory isn't just an academic exercise. It has real-world implications for how we understand our world and each other. But to fully grasp Darwin's theory and its impact on us, I think we first need to understand the two main prongs of his theory. There are many different prongs, but two big ideas. First, Darwin proposed that all creatures, including humans, are descended with modifications from an original, simple, primordial organism. And then second, he proposed that human beings and the rest of nature were produced by a process of natural selection, or sometimes called survival of the fittest, acting on random variations found in nature. This process of natural selection, it's important to understand, in Darwin's view, was supposed to be blind and unguided. You can believe in a guided form of evolution, but that wasn't Darwin's theory, and that's not the mainstream theory of evolution accepted today by most evolutionary biologists. To Darwin and many others, the first prong of the theory, common descent, suggested that there was no fundamental difference between human beings and the rest of nature. And then the second prong had some other consequences. But let's tease out the first prong first, of common descent. In the words of Darwinian philosopher Peter Singer at Princeton University, Darwin showed that we are simply animals. That's what Peter Singer says. Singer is not alone in his view. According to a 2016 survey of American adults, 45% of American adults, nearly half, say they believe that evolution shows that human beings are not fundamentally different from other animals. So, first prong of Darwin's theory has generally been applied to mean that humans aren't unique, that we're not special. You don't necessarily need to take it that way, but that's the way that it has been taken and how Darwin himself took it to some degree. But then we have the second prong of Darwin's theory, which suggested that we're not the intentional creation of a loving creator, but the unintentional product of a blind and purposeless process. In the words of the late Harvard paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson, man is the result of a purposeless a natural process that did not have him in mind. And not only was this Darwinian process blind, it was also ruthless. Human beings, according to Darwin, gained their highest capacities not because those capacities were planned by a beneficent creator, but because natural selection ruthlessly killed off those who didn't measure up. This really can't be emphasized enough, that Darwin enshrined death and struggle for existence as the great engines of progress in human civilization, and actually in all of nature. But as he wrote at the very end, when he was wrapping up of his first book, On the Origin of Species, thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. So imagine that your creator now, in some very real sense, is not someone who planned you, someone who loves you, someone who has a goal for you. It's actually the best things have come about in nature and ourselves from war, famine, death. This Darwinian view has impacted our culture's understanding of the human person in at least three key ways. There are, in fact, many other ways, but because we're not going to be here all night or all semester, I'm going to just nail it down for three. The first is an erosion of the sanctity and value of human life. So we don't have time to really explore in depth the Darwinian impact on the value of human life. I'd encourage you to read my book, Darwin Day in America, if you want to delve in more deeply. But I'd like to mention here a historical example and then discuss the way in which Darwinian thinking still encourages the devaluation of life today. The historical example is scientific racism, the subject of my last documentary, and actually of a couple short documentaries I've done. Now, Charles Darwin, let me be clear, was not the world's first racist. And he was better than some racists in that he opposed slavery, largely through his wife's family who had been involved in abolition. Nonetheless, Darwin helped fuel a particularly virulent form of racism by proposing natural selection as a scientific explanation for why we should expect significant differences in the mental faculties of what he called men of distinct races. Moreover, Darwin contended that the break in evolutionary history between apes and humans came, I'm quoting, between the Negro or Australian, he's talking Australian Aborigine, and the gorilla, unquote. Thus arguing that, in his view, blacks were the closest human beings to apes. Darwin's view inspired a whole generation of scientists like this guy, Ernst Haeckel in Germany, who became preoccupied with trying to use evolution to classify races according to their presumed evolutionary history. This kind of Darwinian racism had really a horrific real-world impact that we'll get to in a moment. But here, what I want to show you is this is Haeckel's. Haeckel is famous for a number of different diagrams. This is one of them. It's his history of human evolution. Note that at the very top, tip top, you have the white, Aryan, Nordic male. That's sort of top of the evolutionary ladder, according to Ernst Haeckel, who, by the way, was a correspondent with Charles Darwin, and they were good friends through correspondence. And then at the bottom, you have the lowest of the apes. Now, also note here, though, you have one ape-like creature that has this protruding nose. Does anyone know what that's probably a caricature of? Jewish person, yeah. So Ernst Haeckel was not only racist, he was also anti-Semitic. But here's the takeaway that Ernst Haeckel had for this diagram, which was reprinted in countless textbooks in various ways. Note that the gap between the highest human and the lowest human, which is number six, is much larger than the gap between the lowest human and the highest ape. That was his takeaway in his textbook, that he was trying to show that the gap between what he regarded as the lowest human, which just happened to be an African, and the highest ape was a smaller gap than between the lowest human, African, and the Teutonic male. Okay. This kind of textbook racism had a real-world impact, especially on Western colonialism and Western colonial policy in Africa, especially on German policy in Southwest Africa in the early 1900s, as I showed in a film that I did called The Biology of the Second Reich. which here's just a snippet. In German Southwest Africa was horrific, but there were also impacts of Darwinian racism in North America. In the United States, our immigration restrictions imposed in the 1920s were largely devised in cooperation with evolutionary biologists who decided that certain races were lower on the evolutionary scale and so should be kept out. The Bronx Zoo, meanwhile, in New York City, put an African man on display in a cage with a monkey as an evolutionary missing link between humans and apes, and something like 250,000 New Yorkers went to see the spectacle. His name was Otabenga, and actually he's largely talked about in my last documentary, Human Zoos. We also sterilized, against their will, including in both South and North Carolina, but all across America, more than 60,000 women against their will in the name of eugenics, which was an effort to remake humanity by applying the principles of Darwinian evolution to human breeding. Eugenics was promoted by the leading evolutionary biologist at Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, Stanford, and the National Academy of Sciences. Today, Darwinian biology, however, is still employed to devalue life. In the area of abortion, both scientists and activists over the past several decades have appealed to Darwinian theory to justify the claim that babies in the womb aren't fully human, invoking an actually discredited idea now from Ernst Haeckel, remember him, known as embryonic recapitulation. These proponents of abortion argue that human infants replay the history of evolution as they develop in the womb. So this is Haeckel's other famous diagram, and actually probably more famous now than his human evolution one. The idea here is you have embryos of different vertebrates, fish, salamander, tortoise, chick, hog, calf, rabbit, human. You know, they're very different by the time they develop. But what Haeckel purported was the first stage in the process, development in the womb, was supposed to be almost identical. And that was supposed to reflect the most conserved stages of evolution and show how we all have a common ancestor, because you start up at the earliest part of embryonic development for all of these different creatures was almost exactly the same, and then only at the end, reflecting later stages of evolution, did they become different. And this was supposed to signify that, again, we replayed the history of evolution in some sense in the womb. Turns out that scientists today know that this is not true. For one thing, the top line actually isn't the earliest stage. It's actually sort of the mid stage. The earliest stage is a lot different from one another. Even as the mid stage, that's not accurate. We now have photos, and probably at the time of Haeckel, they knew that too. You know, whether he specifically fraudulently did this or was just a shoddy natural scientist, you can debate. But the point of the impact of this here is how it impacted abortion. So the idea is that, well, human infants replay the history of evolution in the womb. So we go through a fish stage, a lower mammal stage, and more before finally reaching the state of being a human being. Thus, if you abort an infant while she's still in the fish stage, it's no more significant than aborting a fish. Now, again, embryonic recapitulation is junk scientist and has been discredited even among evolutionary biologists for decades. That has not stopped this argument from being invoked repeatedly over the past 20 to 30 years by scientists, including National Academy of Scientists geneticists, physicist Carl Sagan a number of years ago, and in the popular discussion. So in a more popular thing, a few years ago, Christopher Hitchens, now deceased, wrote a best-selling book, Why God Is Not Great, that includes this argument as an argument for abortion. And in fact, my wife Sonia and I were just having dinner with a former colleague of mine from Seattle Pacific who is now friends, dating a woman who was a medical doctor trained in one of the best medical schools in the nation, who this was her view. She thinks, well, we undergo that in the womb. That's what she got from her graduate program and was shocked to learn that it's actually not true. So this is still around there. So Darwinism has actually fed into, and if you want more details on this, you can read the chapter on it in my book, Darwin Day in America, has fed into a lot of the arguments from 1960s, including Roe v. Wade and the background of that, up to the present day in sort of supporting justifications for abortion. Now, Darwinism feeds into the culture of death in more subtle ways as well. Prominent Darwinians believe that humans aren't inherently more valuable than any other animal. So how we treat animals, we should treat humans, according to evolutionary biologist Jerry Coyne at the University of Chicago, who's one of America's most prominent current evolutionary biologists. He has argued on his blog for legalizing infanticide for babies with biological defects. Because, he wrote, after all, we euthanize our dogs and cats when to prolong their lives would be torture, so why not extend that to humans, unquote. Coyne recognizes that the reason we don't do so right now is because of a view of human beings that Darwinism has yet to completely overcome. As he wrote, quote, the reason we don't allow euthanasia of newborns is because humans are seen as special. And I think this comes from religion, in particular the view that humans, unlike animals, are endowed with a soul. When religion vanishes, as it will, so will much of the opposition to both adult and newborn euthanasia, unquote. The same Darwinian devaluation of human life can be found among a number of activists in our society who can simply be called anti-human.
Today, Darwinian ideas influence the views of many of the most strident anti-human activists. In September 2010, longtime environmental activist James Lee took hostages at the headquarters of the Discovery Channel cable network. Lee demanded that the Discovery Channel change its programming to highlight what he regarded as the planet's biggest enemy, humans. In his list of demands, Lee called on the Discovery Channel to talk about evolution, talk about Malthus and Darwin until it sinks into the stupid people's brains. Sir David Attenborough is one of the world's most respected wildlife filmmakers. In a 2013 interview, he denounced humans as a plague on the earth. According to Attenborough, in the past, natural selection kept humans in check by killing them all. But modern society undermines natural selection by saving the sick and finding ways to feed more and more people. Other activists today invoke Darwinian ideas in order to deny that humans have special value. Christopher Maines was an early leader in the influential environmental group Earth First. In his book, Green Rage, he argues that evolution means there is no basis for seeing humans as more advanced or developed than any other species. According to Maines, human beings are not the goal of evolution because evolution has no goal. In his words, evolution simply unfolds, life form after life form, and Darwin invited humanity to face the fact that the observation of nature has revealed not one scrap of evidence that humankind is superior or special, or even particularly more interesting than, say, lichen.
That was a direct quote.
The use of Darwin's theory to debunk human dignity spans the ideological spectrum. Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer is author of the book, A Darwinian Left. Singer claims that the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee.
Now, where does Peter Singer get this from? He's told us in an interview, Peter Singer made very clear that his view was going back to Darwin. He said, Darwin really showed us that human beings aren't special. We're not so separate from the rest of nature. We're not unique. And so that we should be treated that way. And so this idea that there's something special or unique about human beings, that human beings deserve special treatment, really is undermined by Darwin in Peter Singer's view.
The same dismissal of human uniqueness can be found among some on the right. John Derbyshire was a longtime writer for the conservative journal National Review. In 2012, he was dismissed after writing an article for another publication, arguing that blacks are more antisocial and less intelligent than whites. Derbyshire believed that racial differences are the products of evolution. He also believes that Darwinian theory refutes the claim of traditional Western monotheism that human beings are exceptional. In his words, the broad outlook on human nature implied by Darwinian ideas contradicts the notion of human exceptionalism. To modern biologists informed by Darwin, we are merely another branch on nature's tree.
Ideas do have consequences. But let's go on to a second one. A second impact of Darwin's theory has had, really, is on our view of human beings in the area of morality. In his book, The Descent of Man, Darwin depicted morality not as something permanent or transcendent, but simply as those behaviors and beliefs favored by natural selection because they promoted physical survival under a given set of circumstances. In the Darwinian view of ethics, morality radically changes over time based on the changing conditions for physical survival. If parental love promotes survival, then that becomes moral. If selective infanticide promotes survival better, then that becomes moral. Darwin's reductionistic account of the development of morality leaves little room for objectively preferring one morality of one society over another. According to Darwin's framework, every behavior that occurs regularly in at least some subpopulation almost by definition is normal for that subpopulation. Moral and immoral behaviors develop for the very same reason, to promote physical biological survival. Now, for the most part, Darwin himself didn't press this relativistic analysis to its logical conclusion, but he certainly laid the groundwork for others who came after, and it has had an impact. In the United States, some 55% of adults, according to a survey again, now believe that evolution shows that moral beliefs evolve over time based on their survival value in various times and places. Perhaps nowhere has the Darwinian view of ethics had more severe impact than in family life and human sexuality. It's not an accident that the thinker most responsible for the breakdown of traditional sexual ethics in our culture was a Harvard-trained evolutionary zoologist. His name was Alfred Kinsey. Adopting a thoroughly Darwinian approach to sexual morality, in which he had been trained as an evolutionary zoologist, Kinsey argued that any sexual practice, and he really did mean any sexual practice, that could be found somewhere among some mammals could be regarded as what he called, quote, normal mammalian behavior, unquote, and therefore be regarded as all right. Today, many evolutionary psychologists have gone beyond mere sexual relativism and are affirmatively arguing against monogamy. They claim that we were bred by Darwinian evolution to have multiple partners, which means that we are programmed for promiscuity and infidelity. In their view, the very idea of faithful monogamous marriage, which is extolled by the Judeo-Christian tradition, but that very idea contradicts our biology and must therefore be eradicated. One of the most prominent popularizers of this view, an evolutionary psychologist who advocates this view, is named Christopher Ryan. who co-authored a 2012 New York Times bestseller called Sex at Dawn. In his words, marriage in the West isn't doing very well because it's in direct confrontation with the evolved reality of our species. Ryan says he wants to save marriage by making it consistent with Darwinian biology. For him, that means redefining marriage to include multiple partners at the same time. You can debate, I suppose, whether that's saving marriage or destroying it by redefining it. In any case, ideas really do have consequences. Okay. Third impact that I want to talk about tonight of Darwin's theory has been really an erosion of the idea that human beings, that you and I, have and were designed to have a spiritual purpose. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, again, humans have eternal souls and our lives serve a higher purpose because we've been intentionally created by a loving God. But if Darwinism really proves that life is the product of a blind and unguided process that didn't have us in mind, then God is either impotent or most likely non-existent. And if God doesn't exist, there is no higher spiritual purpose for human life. Indeed, there is no likelihood that human beings have eternal souls. It should therefore be no surprise that according to a survey by researchers at Cornell University of leading scientists in the field of evolution, 87% deny the existence of God, and basically the same amount disbelieve in life after death. The claim that science somehow disproves the existence of God or the reality of the spiritual aspect of human life can have tremendous consequences. In 2013, NPR, National Public Radio, ran a story on why young people in this audience, are abandoning their faith in God. Among others, they interviewed one young man who said, "I don't believe in God, but I really want to. But looking right at the facts, evolution and science, they're saying, no, there is none." Now, even those who don't lose their belief in God because of Darwinian theory may give up their belief in an active and all-powerful God. Thus, it's increasingly popular among Christian proponents of evolution to claim that because evolution is an unguided process, God himself doesn't know how it will turn out and doesn't guide it specifically. Again, indeed, God may not even know how it will turn out. In this view, human life is no longer something specifically intended by God. Accordingly, we have Catholic priest George Coyne, who had been the director of the Vatican Observatory, proclaiming that not even God could know with certainty that human life would come to be, because evolution is an unpredictable process even to God. It's a process that doesn't have an end result in view. It's a non-purposeful, non-teleological process. Christian biologist Ken Miller of Brown University, author of the popular book Finding Darwin's God, argues similarly that mankind's appearance on this planet was not preordained, that we're here as an afterthought, a minor detail, a happenstance in a history that might just as well have left us out. This is a book, actually, that is used at Christian colleges and universities to teach students about how to think about Darwinian evolution. It was used at the school where I had tenure at to teach students how to reconcile their views on science and faith. Now, of course, that's sort of the Christian Darwinist. The message of secular Darwinists is that science shows that the spiritual side of life is a myth. You can believe in God if you want to, but it's tantamount to a fairy story. The consequences of this worldview are bleak, but thankfully the story doesn't end there. While Darwinism has eroded our culture's respect for human life, I'd say in recent decades, scientists and philosophers at the highest level have started questioning this sort of blind materialistic orthodoxy. One of these scientists was my friend, the late Dr. Philip Schell. Dr. Schell was a renowned professor of chemistry at Penn State University, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He spent much of the last decade of his life publicly raising questions about the evidence for Darwin's theory. He wrote, as you can see on the screen, that Darwinian evolution has functioned more as a philosophical belief system than as a testable scientific hypothesis. This quasi-religious function of the theory is why many scientists make public statements about the theory that they would not defend privately to other scientists, unquote. Then there's atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel, who in 2012 published a book with Oxford University Press titled Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is almost certainly false. That was the subtitle of the book. To be sure, Nagel is still an atheist, but after examining the evidence, he's become completely unpersuaded of Darwinian explanations of mind, morality, and life itself. Indeed, he derides Darwinism as what he calls a heroic triumph of ideological theory over common sense. And he concludes that the Darwinian worldview, in his words, again, a quote, is ripe for displacement. But it's not just that scientists and philosophers are now questioning Darwinian theory as never before. Science itself is really revealing stunning evidence that life is the product of design, purpose, rather than an unguided process. And it's been shedding new light on how humans really are special. One of my colleagues at Discovery Institute is Australian biologist and geneticist Michael Denton. Dr. Denton has both an MD from Bristol University and a PhD in biochemistry from King's College in London. His research into retinal disease has led to the identification of the gene used in the first successful gene therapy trial at Moorfield Eye Hospital in London. Dr. Denton has increased my own sense of wonder about both our universe and about ourselves. He writes about how our world is exquisitely fine-tuned for life to exist in ways that go far beyond what chance processes could create. For example, everyone in this room right now is breathing oxygen. But we likely take that for granted. Here's just a little snippet of why we shouldn't.
As you're sitting there, it's breathing air, it's relaxing, you're using up 250 mils of oxygen every minute. It's incredible. That's the amount of oxygen you need to maintain your energy levels. And you need about 20% or so oxygen in the atmosphere to get sufficient to feed your metabolic needs.
The problem with needing so much oxygen in the atmosphere is that oxygen is dangerous because it's so reactive. If you have too much of it in the atmosphere, you can have spontaneous combustion. Fortunately, the form of oxygen prevalent in our lower atmosphere is diatomic. That means two atoms of oxygen typically combine together into a molecule. Diatomic oxygen happens to be much less reactive, so long as the temperature is below 50 degrees centigrade or 122 degrees Fahrenheit.
And this allows, in fact, a quite a high level of oxygen in the atmosphere without spontaneous combustion.
The properties of diatomic oxygen mean our atmosphere has just the right level of oxygen we need for living. Not too little, and not too much.
If you raise the level of oxygen much more than 20%, perhaps certainly more than 30%, you have a raging of spontaneous fires all over the place, okay?
An equally serendipitous property of diatomic oxygen is that it does not absorb heat, which has helped prevent a massive increase in Earth's surface temperature that would wipe out life as we know it.
If it had been a greenhouse gas, forget it, we wouldn't be sitting here. In fact, oxygen absorbs no incoming radiant heat because it's a diatomic molecule. So it goes on and on and on. It's one coincidence after another.
And there's a lot more, but didn't have time to show it. That's from another documentary I did called Privileged Species. Also available, you can just watch it on YouTube. But it's not just that nature is amazingly set up to make life possible. It's also that we human beings are truly exceptional in numerous ways. Here are five.
Our brains have intellectual powers, including mathematical reasoning, that far surpass the capabilities of other animals. The physical design of the human larynx enables us to utilize a much broader range of vowels and consonants than any other mammal, facilitating sophisticated verbal communication of complex ideas. The human hand is better adapted than any other known appendage for the intelligent manipulation of the physical environment. The human body and mind seem to be optimized in a variety of ways to make us the only animal who can harness the use of fire, which opened the doors to technology. Finally, humans live on a planet that seems optimized for scientific discovery. Our clear atmosphere and location in the galaxy enable many of the observations that have fueled modern science. Humans are not only equipped with the potential for self-reflection and scientific reasoning, they are placed on a planet that allows for that potential to be fulfilled. Far from being insignificant specks living on an insignificant planet, humans are truly a privileged species, inhabiting a home that seems to have been prepared for their benefit.
In my view, discovering the fitness of the universe, the unique fitness of the universe for carbon-based life and being like ourselves, is one of the major discoveries of 20th century science, and one of the major discoveries of all time in the area of design, religion, science, and all these sorts of things. The human form is something significant in the cosmic order, and that's a scientific finding. It's implicit in astrobiologists thinking about looking for carbon-based life somewhere else and looking for oxygen on the planet. The 20th century has shown the human form is not some irrelevance, not some freak of nature. It's deeply significant. For me, I think, I can't think of any discovery that's going to come in the 21st century which would be more significant than this action. It's a very significant finding.
Okay, I love that what Darwinian science tried to take away from humanity, new discoveries in the sciences have been restoring. And when people encounter these discoveries for the first time, it can be life-changing. Every summer in Seattle, Discovery Institute brings together upper division undergraduate students and graduate students from all over the world to study some of the compelling evidence of design in nature at a really deep level, 9 days, like 9 a.m. in the morning until 9 p.m. at night. And each summer we see how this real evidence, when you actually study it in depth, can give a lifeline to those who've been told that we're just the products of a blind process that did not have us in mind. One alumnus of our summer program is now a Fulbright scholar at, he actually came from another country, but he's now a Fulbright scholar at one of America's leading research universities. He shared with us how he grew up loving science in his particular country until he started studying it at a university, where he was repeatedly told by his professors that the material universe is all there is and that science shows we're the result of purposeless accidents. Then he actually found, even though he wasn't in the United States, this is a country that doesn't even speak English, that he found some of my colleagues actually on YouTube. And he said, this is a quote, "For the first time in my life, science does not mean materialism for me, and I started to see the signature of a designer," unquote. So I hope the same will be true for you and for your friends and the people in your realm of influence. And with that, thank you. And let's have some time for discussion. I do want to say, if there are any students who are upper division undergraduates through graduate students through actually postdocs in the sciences or in also the social sciences and humanities who wants to study these things at a deeper level, we do have this summer program. We pay all expenses, 9 days in Seattle in July, when it's probably maybe nicer than here in South Carolina in July. I don't know. Now is nicer here than in Seattle in April. And the deadline for that is actually on Monday. So I thought I would just let you know about that. But now let's engage in some discussion. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. But it seems, in a sense, like a vague-ish idea. So how are they proving that scientifically rather than just, okay, we're assuming that because there is so many steps to how things
great, work. Great question. I'm not the perfect person to answer it because I happen to be a humanities and social scientist person. But so design detection, how do you make that in a rigorous way? And so that is what some of our more than 40-plus fellows have spent a lot of time on. And so I refer to two people in particular, and I'll give sort of a thumbnail sketch of them, but you should go to them directly to get more of it. One would be a guy named mathematician named William Dembski, who wrote a book with Cambridge University Press called The Design Inference, where he actually gives what he calls an explanatory filter of how you can make a design inference based on what he calls specified complexity, I'm not going to go into that so much. Let me go to the other one, which I can explain more. Philosopher of science, Stephen Meyer, in two books, which I, if you're really interested in how do you make a rigorous case for design, not an argument from ignorance, an argument based on knowledge, would be his book, Signature in the Cell, and Darwin's Doubt. What Meyer makes, and I'll just get a thumbnail sketch so you get of how he argues. Meyer came up with how you could articulate intelligent design in the same way that Darwin articulated his theory. So in historical sciences, when you're trying to explain something from a long time ago, you can't just do an experiment in the lab. I mean, to figure out what happened a billion years ago. You have to try to piece together potential causes. And Charles Lyell, who was a formative in modern geology, who was also a friend of Charles Darwin, came up with the idea that nature has these uniform causes, and that one way that you, if you're trying to look to explain something like layers of ash or something, you want to look to causes now in operation that we know. You try to look at what potentially could cause it and what are all the potential causes, and then you apply something called really it's a theory of multiple competing hypotheses, and then you basically try to test each of them. Well, are any, so here's the universal causes we can think of. Here's five potential causes of things that we know could produce that effect. Then you go through one by one and see what evidence you can weigh on that, and then basically the last man standing is the best cause insofar as you know, I mean, based on the information. And that's actually how Darwin framed his own theory of evolution. And so Meyer, and actually he did this when he was in his PhD studies at University of Cambridge in England, where he began to think about this. Well, could you make the same sort of scientific theory using the exact same method of scientific theory that Darwin does for intelligent design? Because, and he, that's sort of been his life project to do that. So that's another, a more common sense way, but it's actually very rigorous, and it is the way that many theories have been framed in the historical sciences, when things that you can't do experiments on. Now, you can do experiments on pieces of stuff, but if you're really trying to explain, say, for example, 500 million years ago, according to standard geological dating, was something called the Cambrian explosion, where in about 10 million years, 10, 15 million years, some actually say 3 to 5 million years, there's this burst of biological complexity sort of in the same level in the fossil record. So how do we explain that? We have the fossils. We know what was before and after, but we can't do an experiment about what happened 500 million years ago. And so you apply this either, you know, so what are the potential causes that we know? And that's actually what Steve Meyer does in his book, Darwin's Doubt. You go through self-organization theory, all the basic major things that have been described. But of course, intelligent causes are one thing. We know that when you have bursts of complex things for a purpose in our own uniform and repeated experience, that often points to an intelligent cause. And so that's a potential cause too. And so that's, again, I'm giving just a very thumbnail sketch, but I say if you want a more rigorous answer to that, in the books Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, or some of Bill Dembski's books for his way of design detection. But that, you're right, that is a big question. How can you detect whether something is the product of an intelligent cause or not? And I say Darwin's theory, I'm burbling on, but Darwin framed his theory of evolution by natural selection with the background of saying that, you know, things look designed. And so based on our own uniform and repeated experience, when we see things that are functional with many different parts and functioning toward a purpose, that is the hallmark of the product of a mind. And if we see that certainly in the things humans create. And so Darwin admitted that is true, but he thought he could defeat that because he thought he had come up with another answer that could mimic the effects of design, which was natural selection acting on these random variations in nature. So if you just have natural selection or survival of the fittest and you give me some variations in nature, I can get you everything. Anyway, so a little bit on that. Yes? Oh, yeah.
You mentioned, I forget the Catholic Archbishop's name, and then also Kenneth Miller.
Yep.
And his book on meetings.
Finding Darwin's God.
Christianity, or Evolution of God in the Middle. I'm struck by the two quotes you put up from them, coming from a Christian perspective, coming from the idea of man made in the image of God. But I can understand them saying, we'll accept evolution. But I'm curious if you're familiar at all with what their arguments were to also then accept Christianity if they're willing to say man is happenstantial. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I can't speak about Father George Coyne. I don't know why he would say. Ken Miller also doesn't. I mean, Ken Miller, I think, was willing to accept some evidence of cosmic fine-tuning. I've heard that some of his own views on religion from people who've interacted with him have decayed some. So I don't know that. Let me give you an example on the Protestant side. So Carl Giberson, who co-founded a group called Biologos with Francis Collins, he was one of the original founders. It was actually Daryl Falk, Carl Giberson, and Francis Collins who jointly founded it. He's no longer affiliated with it. He wrote a book called Saving Darwin, where he actually also goes into some of these things. He actually has a chapter on dissolving the fall, where he basically says that human beings, and this, if you're a Christian, this is a problem, but and he was purporting at that time to be an evangelical Christian, that because evolution is driven by selfishness, that no humans could have ever been morally at right with God. And that rather than there be a fall, that we were created morally innocent, we were always sort of botched and evil, and then if anything, if there's going to be a release from the fall, it's, you know, we're going to become better and more perfect later, but that we've always been botched. In fact, he has a whole little section dissolving the fall, and so you'd wonder, well, why would he say he believes in Christianity? I once had the chance to be with a forum with him at Biola University, and I think it's even online. You could probably watch it. And there's a very poignant part of his book near the end where he actually answers the question. He says, so why do I continue to believe in God? His answers were along the lines of, well, my parents, I forget if they were missionaries or something else, they would be distraught. My family would just be distraught. I have a wonderful church of people who love me. I'd have to leave. He was teaching at a Christian college. These were all sociological answers. They weren't about the truth, and it was very sad. And in fact, some of people like atheist Jerry Coyne, evolutionary biologist who I cited, they made fun of that book. Sometimes what's interesting, some of the theistic Darwinists think that they're somehow making Christianity or making their theological beliefs acceptable. Well, actually, the atheist evolutionists poked fun at this particular book because they said, how sad. This person is saying, well, he's continuing to believe because basically for sociological reasons. And I raised that actually in the conversation to his face, and he didn't really engage in it. So I think it's probably different for different people, but I think a lot of it is that's how they grew up.
Dr. West, I'm curious to know, what are some challenges that you face as a believer in your field? How do you combat some of those arguments?
Yeah, so the social sciences, where I come out of, are certainly not known for being Christian friendly, and things like moral relativism and other things is very much encountered. You know, I'd say, though, that the number one thing is you have to realize, who do you want to please? And so if your goal is to be liked, now, of course, we shouldn't be offensive to people. You should try, and this isn't a reason to, you know, to bash people in the head. I get that. But if your underlying goal is that you get your self-worth because other people like or applaud you, then that's a problem. And especially as the culture goes further and further diverges, say, from, say, if you happen to be a Christian, it further diverges that, then there's no longer, you know, you're going to be on sinking sand. I mean, you're not going to be able to do that. So for good or ill, I came from a family of contrarians, and my wife can tell you that my sisters are very, one's an attorney, one was a school teacher. Anyway, background. I mean, is it just that someone says one thing and you just contradict them? So is there something in? I don't say that actually necessarily as a good thing, because there's really a downside on that. But so I do think from earliest going through public education through until graduate school and private secular education, had to get into a mode of being willing to push back and realizing that if you did do that, yes. There are people who stamp you out and persecute you and discriminate against you, and I have had some of that. But then there are also other people who are going to respect you for that, if you do it in the right way. And I remember one of my most beloved professors in graduate school, since deceased, was an agnostic Jewish professor, Pulitzer Prize winner. And we got into some tangles about Christianity, because he thought all Christians were anti-Semitic, and he had some reason, some tragic reasons for that growing up, where some people who claimed to be Christians beat him up because didn't want him on the baseball team and called him Christ killer. So I think those of us who are Christians need to understand that there are lots of people who have held, you know, Christian beliefs and acted in ways that Jesus would be horrified by, and then in some sense, you know, we have to own up to that. On the other hand, he ended up respecting me, and which I give him a lot of credit to. So I think the number one thing is make sure that you want the approval of God and want the approval of what's really true. And don't keep taking your sense of approval from everyone around you. Now, having said that, I think there are things that you can do to, let me give you sort of a contrarian example. Sometimes people want to be, I want to stand for the truth, so I'm going to shove it down someone else's throat no matter what. Or someone, if you're thinking of going to graduate school, there are perfect ways to survive, not perfect ways, you can survive and thrive in graduate school, that even if, say, you're skeptical of Darwinian theory, you need to be careful how and when and if you even express that. I'm not talking about lying. I think Christians ought to be, speaking as a Christian, I think you should be truthful. But that doesn't mean you need to spill your guts. And I remember counseling one person who was, they graduated from a summer program, was in it. Anyway, they had been accepted to a graduate position in biology at a state university and had been taken on in a lab, but felt very bad that they, because they hadn't basically told the person who was getting them about their real views about Darwin's theory. And I said, and our staff person who was counseling the person said, there's no, if they haven't asked you, don't do that. You're not obliged to do that. Why are you doing this? But that just person just felt they had to do it. So they did it. They no longer had a position. And so I do think, and I don't think there's anything morally blameworthy about not spilling your guts to people. And so I do think there is some prudence involved that one needs to learn. So, yeah. Thank you for doing that. My first love was the impact of people of faith, particularly Christians, could have on a positive sense in political science. And when I chaired the Department of Political Science at the institution where I had tenure, I taught a course in both Christianity and American politics and Christianity and world politics. And so before I got into the more negative sort of impact of what I call scientific materialism on politics, I would say, what's the positive impact? So there is a lot of that. I would say, actually, the first book I wrote, The Politics of Revelation and Reason, is how, from the American founding to about 1835, how evangelicals were involved in a number of things, from fighting Cherokee Indian removal, beginning the fights of slavery, although a lot of that came after 1835, and then a lot of other positive social reform. So I'd say there are a lot of good things that can happen. I see there are lots of dangers. And I think one thing that I think it's useful to learn about Christians in American politics in the 1700s and early 1800s, because some of them had an appreciation for what in Christian terms we call general revelation or common grace. And I think if you look for myself, say, from the 1980s to today, there are some segments of American evangelicals who, I don't want to say that they're, well, I want to be careful how I say this, but they think their view, you have to articulate your views in politics based just on the Bible. Now, I think the Bible should inform what you're doing, but when you're offering a public argument, I also believe that God created, you know, he wrote the law, the moral law on people's hearts. Now, you can deface it, get all that, but that gives us common ground, and so I don't think Christians should be unwilling or scared of articulating common ground arguments to find common ground with people who aren't Christians or who are nominally Christians. And so that would be my one bit of advice to focus on that. And then just, have any of you read C.S. Lewis? So, well, read his little essay, The Inner Ring. Or if you want a fictional version of it, read his novel, That Hideous Strength. Probably one of the biggest, and I've had various involvements at various levels with politics, and also had students who worked in Congress and worked at think tanks in D.C. and done other things, and when I went to Harvard Law School. And so I politics feeds egos and feeds what Lewis calls the inner ring of, you know, wanting to get in more and more in the sort of inner sanctum where the power is, and that's dangerous. Particularly for Christians, particularly if you want to stay a whole person. So now, that sounds more negative. But there are certainly most of the things in American history, whether you talk about the prison reform even today, whether you talk about arguments against sex slavery, whether you talk about the ending of abortion, if you actually talk about who was arguing against these human zoos of putting non-white races on public display in cages. It was primarily ministers who were arguing against it, and so or against the eugenics movement of forced sterilization. It was Catholic and some evangelicals, others who were pushing against it. And so there's a lot to be proud with a small p for of what people of faith did it right. And so I think we can also learn from that too. So what do you want to do? State government, national government? International, okay. Yeah. Okay, wow. That's State Department, Foreign Service, possibly, or
State Department.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people who do that. In fact, in our church, we have, this is amazing, a lady whose husband, he was in the State Department and has some fascinating stories to tell, but their two sons ended up being at the same time ambassadors to two different countries. For one sentence, it was amazing. So, and they were not political appointees; they were, you know, long-term foreign service. And so, yeah. That's, anyway. So, yes.
Yes. Please correct me if I have this wrong, but Lewis says that the Bible
teaches
us Darwin's evolution naturally leads to some of the racist things that we saw happen. Or are you saying it just has
okay. So I was, in all fairness, given the title to speak on, so I kept the title. I do not, so I thank you for raising it. So I would not say that these are all necessarily lead to. On the other hand, neither would I say it's just happenstance. So in the case of racism, what was, and I tease this out in my book, Darwin Day in America, because, you know, common refrain is people say, well, you know, everyone was racist at the time, and there's some truth to that. But if you believe, as Darwin did, and this is how they actually framed it, and this is what made it so pernicious, because it was so tied to a scientific theory, that the reason we have the capabilities we have is not because we were ingrained either by a designer or by just nature permanently that humans were ingrained. It's because of a happenstance of what your ancestors, what environment they were in, and what natural selection programmed for them. And then you realize that there are all these different human subpopulations around that are in different environments where natural selection is acting differently on them. That gives you pretty good reason to believe, or that's what Darwin thought, and that's what, say, Jim Watson, Nobel laureate, got him into trouble, saying that you should expect significant differences because, again, there's not something fundamentally that, I mean, in some ways, in the Darwinian sense, now we're not just talking about change over time here, or that things happen billions of years. We're talking about Darwinism, strictly speaking, is this unguided process, and so the things that we see don't reflect some permanent reality. It's a happenstance of chance and necessity, of the particular environment you were in and the random variations and what led to survival in that environment. And so if some other human population or ancestral population goes back to a different environment, you should expect significant differences. That's how they argued. And I think that's a rational argument based on that system. Now, is it a necessary argument? Not necessarily. You could come up maybe with some explanation. But it isn't just like happenstance that say everyone was racist then. Well, to some degree, but Darwin helped, as Stephen Jay Gould put it, who was a Darwinian, he really gave a resurgence to a scientific brand of racism that made it harder to argue against because now I say, well, this is what science shows. And it was a very close relationship to the theory. So.